This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The death penalty is the ultimate denial of human rights. It is the premeditated, cold-blooded killing of a human being by the state. While this cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment is done in the name of justice, it violates the right of life as proclaimed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Building Bridges opposes the death penalty in all cases, without exception, regardless of the nature of the crime, the characteristics of the offender, or the method used by the state to kill the prisoner.
We're joined by Stephen Bright, President and Senior Counsel of the Southern Center for Human Rights, law professor who twice argued in one case before the United States Supreme Court involving racial composition of the juries. He has testified on many occasions before committees of both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives. His and the center's work has been the subject of a documentary film, Finding for Life in the Death Belt, and two books, Proximity to Death and Finding Life on Death Row.
Before we hear from Stephen Bright, let's listen to a brief statement from the sister of Troy Davis, Martina Correa, and a commentary from Death Row journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal on the execution of Troy Davis.
What we need to do is we need to let politicians know that you will not be elected if you do not do something about these atrocities that are happening in our state and in the prison and jail system. We will not sit by while you idly put our children of school age in prisons and jails. We will not sit by and watch you deter movements of change. But I'm here to tell you that I'm going to stand here for my brother today.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Troy Davis, Movement Lessons. The state judicial murder of Troy Davis of Georgia showed both the limits and the successes of the anti-death penalty movement. It seems silly to speak of successes when a man is poisoned to death by judicial decree, but though they were partial, they were successes nonetheless. To attain the support of people like former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, Pope Benedict XVI, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and former FBI Director William Sessions was no small feat. It showed the reach of the movement to procure such support. The movement was also fueled by such revelations as shown by the recantations of people like Antoine Williams, who was one of the state's witnesses. Williams later stated, quote, "After the officers talked to me, they gave me a statement and told me to sign it. I signed it. I did not read it because I cannot read. I felt pressured to point at him," unquote. Was there police coercion in Davis's case? The DA certainly thought so, and was quoted as saying, "Oh, well, they were probably coerced by the defense, too, so that balances it out, and we should still kill him." Think about that. What power of coercion does the defense possess? Handcuffs? Threats? Jail cells? Criminal charges? Death sentences? That any prosecutor can say something so dopey is, well, nuts. The Troy Davis movement amassed almost 1 million signatures on petitions. Remarkable. But signatures on paper or online aren't people in the streets. If 1 million people were on the march, maybe he would be alive. Maybe. The limits of the law, blockades imposed in part, ironically, by a former constitutional professor who came to be seen as the first black president, I speak here of Bill Clinton, also denied Troy Davis true redress. Troy Davis's family and supporters brought much to the anti-death penalty movement. I hope they're not too disheartened to continue the struggle. Such struggle will ensure that Troy Davis will not be forgotten. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, I wanted to just set the pace for our discussion with Stephen Bright. And indeed, Stephen, if we could pick up some of what Mumia Abu-Jamal himself on death row laid out, do we have a fair and equitable system such that there are fail-safes against tragedies of execution of the innocent?
Well, I think the answer is no, and I would say he gave a very good summary of the case and the situation there. But I think the entire criminal justice system, at least in terms of its dealing with poor people, is a very crude instrument. Most poor people are represented by court-appointed lawyers. Very often they don't have the expertise or the resources, and often they carry such huge caseloads that they can't really provide individual representation to people. So we have innocent people that are, people admit now that there are a lot of innocent people that have been convicted in all kinds of cases because DNA evidence has revealed beyond any doubt that many people who were convicted by juries were in fact completely innocent. The unfortunate thing is that's only 10% of the cases that they can have some bodily fluid that can be tested with DNA. The other 90% of the cases, I think there's an equal number probably of innocent people, but you don't have that ability to prove conclusively that a person is innocent.
If we can pick apart and go maybe piece by piece of the justice system and look at the problematic within that for cases that involve a request for the death penalty. Maybe we can start with, you began the issue of representation. Let's parse that out a little bit more, the problem with quality representation. How has that been reflected in people who indeed have been sentenced to death?
Well, very often it's been just disgraceful. I mean, in Houston, which executes more people than any other place, I mean, three people were sentenced to death at trials where the lawyers fell asleep during the trials. One of those people's been executed, and Texas is trying to execute one of the others. So that's how low the standard is. At the time Davis was tried, the local judges in Savannah were just appointing lawyers to represent people. And they didn't necessarily have the expertise in defending a death case. They certainly didn't have the investigative and expert resources that they needed. And the power of the prosecutor is so tremendous here, the ability to tell people, you'll stay in jail until you tell us what we want to hear. As Mumia pointed out, I mean, that's not something the defense can do. Nor can a defense lawyer say, we'll dismiss the charges against you if you testify a certain way. Of course, we can back up one more notch on this. This is not about counsel, but it's a point worth making. When you have identification cases, you have the greatest likelihood of mistakes being made. I don't doubt that there was coercion here, but I also think that people trying to reconstruct what happened in a parking lot at 1 o'clock in the morning when it was dark and gunshots were being fired and all that, you're not going to get a very accurate portrayal of what happened at that time.
The issue of poverty, economic status, and the issue of race, how does that factor into those who lose their life through state execution?
Well, Davis is a classic case of a black man charged with the murder of a white man, a police officer. It's the classic death penalty case. Death penalty is reserved pretty much in Georgia and throughout the country for people who kill white people, even though African Americans are the victims of more murders than white people, even though they're only 13% of the population. About 80% of the people on death row are there for murders of white people. And there are no cases that get ratcheted up as much on the race issue as interracial crimes like this one. So that's another factor that comes into play. And when you have the intersection of race and poverty, you have, you know, sort of a double disadvantage in the case that would not be there, you know, if it was a person of means and if it was a white person and so forth.
73% of the executions since, I believe it was 1976, have been in southern states and 38% in Texas. What explains that?
Well, Texas is the easiest to explain. You give someone a very bad lawyer at trial, they get convicted and sentenced to death. Then you give them an equally bad or maybe even a worse lawyer for the review process. In Texas, there have been 10 cases where people didn't even have federal review because the lawyers assigned to them missed the deadline for filing. I mean, that's about as basic as it gets. If you can't file on time, you're really the bottom of the profession. At any rate, so you can execute a lot of people if you do that. And, of course, Texas executed about 475 now. Of those cases where people missed the deadline, one lawyer missed it for three different people. And my question has always been, why didn't the Texas bar step in, or why didn't the Texas court step in? Why didn't somebody say, if this man can't even file on time, he shouldn't be assigned any more cases? He's still handling capital cases today.
The issue of the appointment versus the election of judges. What roles do judges really play in death penalty cases, and what's the significance of whether or not they would be appointed or elected?
Well, in all the states of the old Confederacy, the states that really you were talking about a moment ago, or most of where the executions take place, the judges are elected. And there's no bigger issue in a judicial election than the death penalty. So you have prosecutors running for judge based on how many times they sought and obtained the death penalty. You have judges who know that if they rule against the government in a case, against the prosecution, they're signing their own political death warrant because someone's going to run against them in the next election, and that ruling is going to cost them their job. That's always the issue in judicial elections. I should also say in Alabama, which is one of the other states that contributes to the large number of executions from the South, the judges can override the jury's sentence. So a jury from Alabama can send somebody to life in prison, and the judge can override it and impose the death penalty. And about a fourth of the people on death row, it's about 200 on death row in Alabama, about a fourth of those were overrides where the judge disagreed with the jury. And they almost never override the other way. It's always life to death.
We've looked at the fallibility of eyewitness identification. We've looked at the pressure on the judiciary from elections in conservative areas. And what about the review process? We've been taught to believe that there is an extended appeal process, and that's going to remedy any errors of law that may indeed have been made by the judiciary or indeed in other instances within the context of a trial. Is that the case?
Well, there are two factors there. I mean, first, with regard to what's so important in these cases is the investigation and the development of facts, and facts that may show innocence or facts that may show the death penalty is not appropriate for this person. Those are very difficult for reviewing courts to, well, if they're not presented, there's nothing to review. There may later be a claim of ineffective lawyering. But with regard to a lot of other issues, the Supreme Court and the states have set up so many technical barriers to having appellate courts look at those cases. If the lawyer didn't object at the right time, if the lawyer didn't file a motion, if the lawyer didn't ask for a jury instruction, if the lawyer didn't object to a jury instruction that was given, then the reviewing courts will not look at that. And sort of the irony of this is that a person, you know, death row people don't pick their, or people facing the death penalty don't pick their lawyers. They're assigned to them. So they may be assigned a very bad lawyer who fails to make these objections and file what ought to be filed and whatever, but it's the client. It's the person who is convicted and sentenced to death who pays the price for that. And then, of course, some people, if they miss the deadline for filing, they don't get any review at all. So there just simply is no review, no federal review in those cases. And the federal review is very important because that's the only time that these cases are reviewed by life tenure judges who don't have to worry about being voted out of office if they make a ruling in favor of a death row inmate.
I understand that there's not a right to counsel on the appeals process after the initial conviction. Is that the case? And if that's the case, then do some defendants not have lawyers for that process?
Yes, that is the case. And I should say in non-capital cases, it's almost impossible for a person who's been convicted, even though they may be sentenced to a long prison term or even life without parole, they may not be able to ever challenge their conviction because they just simply don't have a lawyer. And it's a very technical and very much a specialty. So the idea that some inmate is going to do this on his own is sort of like my going to the airport and, you know, getting in the cockpit and flying the plane to New York because the pilot's not there. I mean, it's just not going to happen. In the death penalty cases, generally either some lawyer volunteers, some organization like ours or some other organization comes forward to provide the representation in the state courts. But there have been people who did not have lawyers. Xavius Gibson in Georgia had a habeas corpus hearing in which he represented himself. It's in a death penalty case. And every time the judge called upon him to make a statement or cross-examine or whatever, he said, I don't know what I'm doing. I need a lawyer. And it's just a farce of a hearing. The state, of course, was represented by two lawyers who specialize in capital cases. He is, you know, a young man who probably didn't have even an average IQ, and he's completely baffled by what's going on.
I don't think that many people in New York fully realize that we have states that don't have public defender processes as well, just before we even get to the issue of capital cases.
Right. Well, that's very true. And in states like Alabama and Texas do not have public defenders. They often have court-appointed lawyers appointed by the judge. Sometimes it's a patronage appointment. But when you have that system, you don't develop the expertise that you have in public defender offices where people are trained and supervised and you have some kind of quality control. What usually happens in public defender offices is just the caseloads become impossible. But at least you have people that know what they're doing and are dedicated. Some of the lawyers appointed to cases in Alabama and Texas and other states really are not competent to handle any kind of case and shouldn't be practicing law.
We now have 1,269 persons who were executed since the Supreme Court lifted its ban on the practice in 1976. That's pretty staggering, and it's staggering to know all the inequities. But at the same time, we are moving forward. There seems to be growing indication that, as a matter of fact, I think we have 10 more states before we can really look to the abolishment of the death penalty. But am I correct that there are more jurors, for example, who are showing greater reluctance to vote for the ultimate penalty, among other things?
I was going to say the most encouraging thing that's happening is that the number of death sentences that are imposed every year, I'm not talking about executions, but what juries are doing in terms of imposing the death penalty, in the late 90s it was around 300 a year, which really is not that many when you consider how big the country is, but today it's just over 100. So it's dropped by two-thirds, and it's increasingly isolated to Texas and Alabama, Nevada, a handful of states. And if that trend continues, if the numbers continue to go down and the death penalty continues to be used in only a a small number of jurisdictions. I mean, even in states like Texas, I mean, over 100 of the executions carried out in Texas were imposed in Houston. So that one county, Harris County, accounted for more executions, actually, than any state in the union has carried out, except for Texas itself. And that's what you find in around the country, is that there's these little jurisdictions, not little necessarily, but there are these jurisdictions that account for most of the death sentences in that state. Often you change prosecutors and you don't have the death penalty coming out of those places anymore. But I think a lot of prosecutors have given up on the death penalty. They know it's sort of law enforcement quackery. And I think people generally, I think one thing, as Mumia said, that will come out of the Troy Davis execution, sad as it is that many people will have second thoughts about the death penalty. And I think it will be much harder for prosecutors in Georgia and other places to obtain the death penalty, because many people were shaken to the core by the Davis case. They followed it, they learned about it, they were invested in it, they were sure that the Pardon and Parole Board would do the right thing, and then he was abruptly executed. And I think that shows, and we have other cases from time to time that just show the inequities of the death penalty, and more and more people are learning from that, and I think the result of that is fewer and fewer death sentences. Georgia itself has not imposed a death sentence in a couple of years. It used to impose 15 or 20 every year, so you know, there's a big change going forward. So I hope we will see an eventual abandonment of the death penalty like the rest of the world.
Stephen, you this summer, I know you've argued before the Supreme Court, you this summer had a death penalty case. Just to put in another face on why we are so adamant about the abolition, your own experience that also teaches us to move in the direction and fight for the abolition of the death penalty in the remaining states.
Well, I think very few people understand that the two most important decisions made in every capital case is first the decision whether to seek the death penalty. There are many prosecutors who never seek it. In fact, most, if you look at all the counties in America, most of the prosecutors do not seek the death penalty in states that authorize it. If the prosecutor does seek it, that's usually, not everywhere, but most places, it's a decision made by one person, usually a white man. And then the next decision is whether to plea bargain the case. And most death penalty cases are resolved by those two decisions. There's no judge or jury or anybody else involved in it. But if the prosecutor persists and wants the death penalty, one person can force a case to trial, which is what happened to me this summer, in a case that certainly was not one of the more heinous cases. It was a murder case, so of course it was very tragic, and it was a loss to the community, but it certainly didn't compare to multiple murderers and people that had prior convictions for murder and other people, whatever. But the prosecutor, has political ambitions, insisted on seeking the death penalty, and so we went through long jury selection and ultimately a trial. Unfortunately, came out without the death penalty, but so much of what was put into that case was put in by me and my office, the Southern Center for Human Rights. If it had been left just to the state of Georgia and the lawyers it provided, it could have very well been a different outcome.
Well, Stephen Bright, I want to thank you for the work that you do, most importantly, and for helping us make out the case for the abolition of capital cases, the abolition of the death penalty. And we will continue to follow the work of the Southern Center for Human Rights and yourself. It's too important for a society not to allow the state to execute people in a cold and calculated way. In its name, it just breeds inhumanity. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I think
us.
As I often say, it coarsens the society. It not only is extremely degrading to the person who's tied down and put down, But it's degrading to the society that does it. It says a lot about what kind of people we are and what kind of society we want to have. And we should not be a vengeful, merciless society. I hope someday we won't be.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Stephen Bright, President and Senior Counsel of the Southern Center for Human Rights. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's go to the protests around Troy Davis.
My name is Ann Wright. I'm a retired U.S. Army colonel. I'm a former U.S. diplomat who resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq. And I'm here to challenge U.S. policies on the execution, that we execute people still in this day and time. State-sponsored murder. And there were two people that were executed. One that was a white supremacist racist who drugged a young black man behind his truck. Horrible, horrible crime. And yet the family of that young black man said, don't execute that man. And then we have Troy Davis, an African-American man who, by all indications, did not commit a murder of a police officer. And there's plenty of evidence that the court should have gone back over to look at, and yet they didn't, and he was executed. And so I'm here to say that we must stop the death penalty.
We are Troy Davis! We are Troy Davis!
We are Troy Davis!
Yeah, I came to pay tribute to Troy Davis and his fight. You know, he was on death row. They just executed him. I'm against the death penalty. I think it's racist. I think we need a social movement from the ground up to overturn it, because the politicians aren't going to do it. You know, it has to come from the bottom. The people have to reject it.
Solidarity with brothers and sisters, friends, colleagues, comrades, fighting for an abolishment of the death penalty, but also fighting for justice in the case of Troy Davis. We fought to keep him alive, and now we're going to continue to fight for justice in his death. We believe that there was not enough guilt beyond a reasonable doubt to execute Troy Anthony Davis.
Troy Davis!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.